This is a Harper Guys production.
The following will contain adult subject matter and may not be suitable for all audiences.
Have you ever wanted something so bad, and then when you got it, it was even better than you expected?
Welcome to the gallows.
I'm Jake. With me, as always, my co-host Adam.
Yo.
Start off like we do every show with a little bit of an update on what's going on in the world of capital punishment.
Let's hear it.
So, upcoming executions, we still have Kenneth Wayne Dawson, who is the fourth of the original four federal convicts that are going to be put to death. The first three have already gone. Keith Wayne Dawson actually is going to be executed on 8/28, and it is for the rape and murder of a 10-year-old girl in Texas. He pled guilty, but then was actually denied the recommendation of life by the judge. One of the cases that's interesting because it's in Texas, and Texas does a good job of handling their own, but because of the severity of the crime is why Dawson is actually up on federal charges. Following him, we're going to have John Ramirez, also of Texas, but actually under the Texas state flag. That's going to be on 9/9. Now, as of our last show, that was kind of where we were sitting at the time. Because of all of the moratoriums and stuff that are currently in place in different states, most places have nothing really on the books at this point in time. Well, it's time to get a little more active. The federal government has come back out and said, we're not quite done yet.
Really?
Yes.
Good.
They have added two more names that they have set dates for. Important to note that on these federal cases, when you reach the point of actually putting a date for the execution on these, there is no turning back. The only turning back possibility at this point is the Supreme Court. The odds of that happening on one of these federal cases is almost zero.
Really?
Yes. So we are getting trifecta week coming up the last week of September.
September. So we still got to wait a bit.
A little bit, but it's next month. So on 9/22, we have William LaCroix. This is for the rape, kidnapping, and murder of a 30-year-old Georgia nurse. And this was after he spent 10 years prior to that in a federal penitentiary. So wow. He was in and finally got out. He was out for less than a year and murdered this poor girl. So the state's like, yeah, we're going to go ahead and take that one. That is actually from Georgia, which, again, ironically, Georgia is another state that does have several executions, several in the last couple of years. So for this to be a federal case, it's a little bit different than what we dealt with in, say, the Kansas case.
Right.
Right, where Kansas isn't actually going to execute somebody.
Dumbasses.
2 days later, on the 24th, we have Christopher Villalva. He actually murdered a couple of youth ministers in Texas. It is an especially grisly tale. If you get a chance to read it, it's a pretty satanic thing that he actually ended up doing. I don't want to give the whole story away. Once this comes to fruition, we will have a show that features some of these federal cases. He will most definitely be on it.
Really?
If you want to read about
this guy, sounds like a doucher.
He's not just a doucher. He is the epitome of evil incarnate. He is one of the worst people I've ever read about.
Oh.
I've got some stories in the chamber that are hard for me to dive into because they deal with children on a very disgusting level. This is not a child murder, but what these were is something that I couldn't believe. I've never heard of it. It's that vile of a crime.
Are these going to be on the Patreon, or are these going to be on the regular shows?
We'll see how it works out. I might do one of each to kind of put it out there for both sets, let you have one to taste, and then bring you onto the Patreon to get the other one.
Absolutely.
And then the third one to finish it out, it's actually a week in one day. Texas is going to jump right back into it. A gentleman named Carlos Trevino is going to be executed on 9/30. This piece of work actually raped and murdered his own 15-year-old cousin. Yeah. So there's a chance that guy might get some airtime. He might not, though, too. I struggle with the kids' cases. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We'll definitely make sure that there's some listener discretion advisory on those shows before they get started. It's a tough topic, but I feel like it's something that at some point we're going to have to keep the exposure and more of going on, because it's really disgusting how often this kind of stuff happens to children.
Right.
So that brings us to tonight's show, and it comes out of Oklahoma. So this takes us to a little town called Perry, Oklahoma. Now, Perry sits about an hour north of Oklahoma City, and it's about an hour and 15 minutes west of Tulsa. So if you look at it on a map, it's literally straight up Route 35 to go from Oklahoma City and straight out, I believe it's 70. It's either 70 or 64. I think that you can take either one that comes out of Tulsa and run just straight over. So it's kind of rural, but it has a couple of main routes that actually take you into this town of 5,000. One of the things that it's actually semi-known for is that it is what is considered to be the heart of Tornado Alley. It is not unheard of from April to October to have these sirens going off multiple times a week. It's just, it's in, kind of sits in a plain valley, if that makes any sense. It kind of sits down a little bit, but the way that the formations and stuff work, they get hit with a lot of tornadoes in this area. So a lot of the homes and stuff there are actually structured to withstand it.
Did you say April to October?
Yes, that's
Jesus.
That's the general, I mean, not so many in April, not so many in October. You really go hard between May and September. I mean, they have some insane tornado outbreaks that happen down there.
That's a lot of time.
It is. The one other small thing that they're known for, which I found this to be a little bit interesting about a small town that's got 5,000 people, is they're very, very proud of their high school wrestling program. They have won over 60 state championships in wrestling.
It's pretty good.
I mean, can you imagine if a high school had won 50 state football championships?
It's ridiculous.
It would be the greatest high school football team of all time, right? So I thought that was super interesting.
Well, and they must be the greatest wrestling school of all time then.
Yes. And as you can imagine, in a town this small, you don't get a lot of murder. Well, that's why it makes tonight's story easily the most famous story to ever come out of Perry, Oklahoma. In May of 1999, the class of 99 had just about 100 kids in their graduating class, and they were ready to take on the world. They had their graduation in mid-May, and two of those seniors were named Summer Hare, which that's a great name. Like, I read it a couple times, and I'm like, that sounds like something you're describing. Like, how do I get summer hair? You know? And a friend of hers named Stephanie Neiman. Now, Summer was the fun-loving former cheerleader the whole way through. And the last couple of years of high school, she just decided, you know, work and boys were a little bit more entertaining than being a cheerleader. So she kind of stepped away and finished off her high school career like a lot of kids do, you know? Well, Stephanie, on the other hand, she was really, really boisterous, outgoing personally. Just that loud, I mean, kind of Chris Farley walk in the room, like everybody knows that she's there, you know, but very, very well-liked person. She was known as being a hard worker. She carried a couple different jobs while she was still in high school. She was also one of the main members of the band. She was known for being a member of the band that got everybody pepped up and had a great time. So she was really active in the stuff that she did. Summer was also the kind of person that she would always want to spare other people's feelings, you know, even if that meant like taking on herself, you know, feeling something bad. Stephanie, on the other hand, was built just a little bit different. Stephanie was the only child of her parents, and because of that, she had a really close relationship with them. They taught her the value of hard work, how to always stand up for yourself. You know, you have a voice, make sure that you use it. And if she wanted it, she was going to have to earn it. You hear so many kids that are single, like the only child in their family, that just get everything handed to them, you know, because that's what happens. They were the other way around. They made her earn everything, you know, but not in a negative way, you know, kind of teaching her the ways of life. And they always told her that if she believed in something and that if she really, really cared about it, to make sure that you do anything for that cause or for that person.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a great way to be.
Sure.
You know, like, to, if you're going to do something, put your heart into it.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's some of the best advice I think a parent can really give, right?
And don't give up.
Right.
If you truly want it, stay course.
Yeah.
Stay the course.
So after graduation, Stephanie takes her graduation money and some other money that she had saved up, and she buys a Chevy Silverado. And immediately, the day that she gets it, she's already got this on hand ready to go. She puts a Tasmanian Devil sticker on the window, and she had ordered a custom license plate that just said Taz, T-A-Z-Z-Z. Well, Taz, T-A-Z-Z, was her nickname growing up the whole way through school.
You
know, little Tasmanian Devil, you know?
Sure.
And, like, you got to be pretty badass as a girl to have that, because that's typically, like, how many guys have you known, you know, over the years? Oh, that guy's a little Tasmanian Devil.
Right.
You know? It's not usually something that you say about a woman.
Yeah, exactly. And, I mean, I don't know about you, but he's one of my favorite Looney Tunes of all time.
Oh, yeah, he's fantastic. So on June the 3rd, she's getting ready for work around 9:30. Now, she's only 19 years old at the time, so I thought it was kind of interesting that she's getting ready for work at 9:30. Well, she was actually going into work that night on third shift to make a little bit of extra money. She had a new truck payment to wear, and her parents were making her pay her insurance, obviously, you know. So she was picking up the inventory shift. You know, they did it once a month. It's a chance to go in and make some good money. And she really kind of liked the idea of working late at night, you know. So she's at home getting ready to go, talking to her mom and dad, and she gets a knock on the door, and it's Summer. She seemed like she'd kind of been crying and explained that she had been at a party with her on-again, off-again boyfriend. His name is Bobby Bornt. And after a short argument at the party, he said, you know what, I'm going to go pick up my son from the babysitter, and I'm just going to head home. Well, Summer kind of suspected that he was lying. And she said, you know what, I'm going to go ask Stephanie, can I catch a ride, you know, over to his house to see if he's with another woman or if he actually has a son. Well, Stephanie's kind of hesitant. She's a really good employee. She doesn't like being late for anything. But she says, you know what? We can do that, but we got to go now. So they left immediately. And she said, you know, we got to be in and out real quick. I can get you dropped off. But then you have to let me know if you're coming back with me or if you're staying there. Because I'm only going to have about 10 minutes to spare to make sure that I make it to work on time. So they're riding out to the house, and Summer's just going on about their argument and all this stupid stuff that Stephanie is just not in that headspace. She's enjoying where she's at, everything that's going on, and she just kind of enjoyed the hum of the truck. And, you know, like when you get something that's got a little bit of, you know, where that's what she was into, and she was loving it. So they arrive out at Bobby's house. He kind of lives out in the middle of nowhere, out in the country. So he doesn't live actually in town, Perry. He lives just outside of the city limits. So they pull in and they sit in the driveway for about a minute or so, and they don't really see any movement about the house. So Summer asked Stephanie to wait for her just in case Bobby wasn't home. Like maybe he didn't actually pick up his son to go home. Maybe he's out someplace else doing something. She didn't want to be stranded there, right? So Summer makes her way up to the house and rings the doorbell. Well, Bobby doesn't answer the door. So Summer just decides to go ahead and open the door. I guess if you're close enough with somebody, you might do that. I'm not a big fan of doing that. I have a few friends, a few family members I would do that with. That's not something I would do on
like
the regular.
Where you walk up to the house and you just go right in?
Right.
I do that at like one person's house.
Right. Mine.
Yours.
Right. That's what I'm saying. So, but that's a very small circle
right.
that people do that, right? So she opens the door. She walks in, closes the door behind her. So Stephanie's just outside waiting, like, what's going on, you know? In a few minutes, Summer comes back out to the truck, and she told Stephanie that she needed her help in the house and that she'd explain when she gets there. So they go hustling up to the front door, and they go in, and Stephanie looks on the couch, and she sees Bobby all tied up, laying on the couch, and he's actually bleeding from his mouth and nose and what looks like a cut above his left eye. And she looks right at him, blunt, being Stephanie. She goes, what the hell's going on? Well, as soon as she got the sentence out, the answer came from the side, and she absolutely gets blasted in the rib cage. Bam, takes a punch right to the ribs. So she goes down, drops down on both knees, and she's trying to breathe and get her air back. And she looks up, and she sees a man actually carrying Summer into the bedroom. She'd been over to Bobby's house a couple times to hang out and stuff, to where she knew kind of the layout of the house. So she sees this going on while she's trying to collect herself, and then she sees another man follow in behind him. So she's trying to comprehend what's going on, and next thing you know, she gets hit right in the face. Doesn't know what happened at the time, but she actually got kicked right in the face with a work boot. So literally shuts the lights off. She's out cold, laying on the living room floor. Bobby tied up. Summer's in the bedroom. So we've got a mess going on right now.
This is unbelievable.
Right. So she wakes up. She's not exactly sure how long it took before she woke up. And she is sitting in a bedroom with her hands duct taped behind her back. Her feet are duct taped in front of her, and her mouth is duct taped actually like across her hair. So she's all kinds of bound up at this point in time. So she kind of gets her focus back and just kind of figures out what's going on in the room. And she sees her friend being held down by two men and being raped by another. This assault ends up going on for over 2 hours. All three of these guys rape her multiple times.
Jesus Christ.
Finally, they've had their fill, and they tell someone to get dressed, that everybody's leaving the house. So one of the guys walks up to Stephanie, and he says, "Give me your keys." Stephanie sat there after just witnessing what she'd witnessed, eyes focused forward, looks straight forward, and just says, "No." Well, the rapist becomes unhinged at this and begins kicking her repeatedly in the head, chest, legs, side. I mean, just stomping the shit out of this girl until she is finally able to get her keys and throw them onto the floor. So she's struggling at this point. She doesn't know what happened. Bam, gets hit again. The lights go out again. So she's completely out on the floor again. She starts to come through a second time, and she feels cold, and she's not sure why, as she kind of gets her bearings going on, and she realizes that she is actually in the back of a pickup truck. She's still bound, everything but her mouth. So for some reason, they decided they were going to go ahead and cut the tape off of her mouth. So as she begins to kind of put things together and figure out where she's at, she looks up, and there's headlights that are shining onto the truck that she's in, and she can actually see her Tasmanian Devil sticker. So she knows at that point in time that she's in the back of her own truck and that there's another vehicle that's following them right now. So Bobby is actually in the back of the truck with her. So she starts asking him, what's going on? You know, like, Bobby, like, okay, here's the entire situation. So Bobby at the time, he's 22 years old, and he's with Summer at the time. They're kind of on again, off again. He was the boyfriend, right? So he was telling him, you know, he's one of these guys that he's held down a full job, a full-time job, you know, to make ends meet, to take care of his son. And he smokes some weed. So he's got a little bit of a small side hustle going. Basically, he sells enough weed to pay for the weed that he smokes because he's not making tons of money, but he's trying to make sure that he takes care of his son. I don't know that smoking weed as a young parent is the number one thing that you should be doing, but
probably not.
If you're going to do it, he's trying to do it right. So he goes on to tell her that he's got a friend named Jason who was looking to get started selling a little bit more on a little bit more regular basis. Well, he explains that he saw this as an opportunity to make some real side money without really having to do a lot of work. You know, he goes to his guy, gets a larger amount, sells it off to Jason. Jason goes out and starts slinging it, right? To where he's getting paid for basically holding on to it for a short amount of time. Well, the problem with that was within the first week, Jason's out selling, and he gets approached by a well-known dealer in the area, and he wanted to know where he got the drugs. Well, this is how a man named Clayton Dockett ended up at Bobby's house, because he finds out that Bobby's the one that's actually supplying the drugs. And he shows up to the house with his cousin, Alfonso, and their friend, Sean Mathis. Now, Bobby, like I said, is only holding the drugs for a couple of hours up to one day before he passes them on to Jason. But Clayton didn't know that. He was under the impression that now this guy's sitting on a giant freaking stack of weed. He's coming to take it to try to put these guys out of business, right? So his intent that he says is he was actually just there to try to scare Bobby out of the drug business because he didn't want the competition, which I think that a lot of drug dealers work that way. I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time in that life, you know. And he was just going to rob him, but then Summer and Stephanie showed up, and that's why they all stopped moving. They went into the kitchen, and they just wanted them to go away. They weren't looking for any more confrontation. They were there with Bobby. Well, said the problem was that when Summer walks in the house and he sees Bobby all beat up with three men standing in the kitchen, that now they have to go into action. And they tell her that, hey, we're going to kill Bobby and his baby that's sleeping in the next room if you don't go outside and get Stephanie and bring her to the house right now. We don't need anybody to run to the cops over anything. Which I didn't quite understand that, because at that moment, Summer knows that she doesn't know anything.
Right.
Right? Stephanie's in the car. If she just literally goes to the window and waves her off, she's going to go to work and there's nothing else to be done. Right? So Stephanie's in the back of the truck hearing this entire story from what's going on and the way the whole thing shook out. And she's trying to process it through this pounding headache that she has. And she starts to get pissed off at the situation. You know, it's like, In her mind, she didn't do anything wrong. There was no reason that she should have been involved in any of this. She's supposed to be at work, not being the one that's in a truck, right? So finally, the truck comes to a stop, and Bobbity and Stephanie are pulled out of the back of the truck. They're on a dirt road that's actually near County Road 130 and Harvest Road, and Alfonso is the one that actually pulls them out. The second truck, which actually was Bobby's truck that they had taken too, they pull up behind them, and Clayton and Mathis get out, and they pull Bobby and Summer and Bobby's little boy out of the car. So Clayton tells Summer to give the baby to Bobby, and they put Bobby and Stephanie on the ground behind the one truck, basically sitting all tied up, and he's got the baby laying on his lap. So Mathis and Clayton end up taking Summer down towards this creek bed. She's crying and screaming the whole time, and all of a sudden Clayton stops, and he grabs her by the back of the hair. He pulls out a sawed-off shotgun and puts it right to her head, and he says, "If you want to live, this is what you got to do." Instantly, Summer stops screaming, and she just complies. So over the next hour, the two of the three men rape her multiple times again.
Again?
Out in this creek bed. Yes. So this girl's gone through three hours of multiple rapes from three men.
So why are they only raping this girl?
I really don't have a good answer as to why she was the one that they chose.
Good grief.
So they get done, and they bring Summer back up to the truck, and Clayton tells Mathis, "Grab the shovel and start digging a hole." So it takes him about 20 minutes to get this hole dug, and Clayton says, "Well, somebody's got to go in." Again, according to his testimony, he's trying to scare somebody at this point in time, right? So Mathis grabs Stephanie on Clayton's direction and makes her stand with her back to the hole while Clayton starts interrogating her. And at this point, you got LaFonso on the other side still holding Summer and Bobby at gunpoint. So there's nothing they can really do to help her, right? So Clayton asks Stephanie if she's going to go to the police if they turn her in, if they let her go. And she said, "I will indeed turn you in. Like, all I have is your first names. I don't really know who you are, but I will give them a physical description and I will tell them exactly what happened here tonight." Clayton asks her, "Do you really want to die over trying to send me to prison?" And she says, "I don't think that you're going to kill me." Well, Clayton takes that as an absolute challenge at that point, and he's about 15 feet away from her, from where he'd be yelling. He pulls the sawed-off shotgun out, and he fires a quarter-inch slug straight at Stephanie. The bullet actually enters and explodes her left shoulder and the upper right portion of her chest to where just a big gaping wound instantaneously. Clayton goes to try to fire again while she's on the ground, but his gun's jammed. So now we got Stephanie on the ground. She's laying there screaming, "Oh my God, oh my God," over and over again. Clayton runs back to the truck where he finds a screwdriver, and he's panicking now in this moment. And he's finally able to use a screwdriver to get the gun freed up to where he can get the action to move. He cocks it again, puts another shell in, goes over to Stephanie, puts it point blank, 2 inches away from her chest, pulls the trigger again. The second shot doesn't kill her either. She's now gasping for air, because he's hit one of her lungs, but she's still able to talk, and she's just begging for her life at this point, telling them anything that she can to say, "Hey, I'm not going to tell the cops anything. Just leave me out here. You know, I'll be okay." He says, "You know what? No, this isn't going to work." And he says, "Mathis, take her and drag her into the hole and start shoveling." Now, Mathis, not a good guy by any stretch of the imagination, but he's like, "Dude, she's still alive." He's like, "She's not going to be in a few minutes." So Mathis, who would later claim that he was afraid for his own life, puts her in the hole while she's still alive, still breathing, and fills the hole in. After they've got Stephanie buried, Clayton turns back to Bobby and Summer, and he tells them, he goes, "You know, you guys are parents, so I'm not going to do this to a child. I'm going to let you both live. But if you tell anybody about this murder, I'm going to dig two more holes, and you guys are both going to be right beside her." So they get back in the trucks, and they drive the 20 minutes back to Bobby's house. And he told them, he said, "If you try to leave this house, we're going to kill you. We're going to be watching you the entire time." So they end up leaving Stephanie's truck there, and they fled in Bobby's truck. So from what I can find, it sounds like they had actually walked to the house from someplace or been dropped off. but that was never proven conclusively exactly how they got there, and it was never really in any of the testimony about how they actually arrived at his place out in the middle of nowhere without a vehicle.
So Stephanie's in the hole.
Yes.
Summer, Bobby, and the child
yes.
are back at the house.
Are back at the house, and then they leave with less than $100 in cash and less than $200 worth of weed. That's it. That's what they got out of this whole thing. So at about 8 a.m., Bobby looks out the window for like 20 minutes. He's scanning everything. I mean, he lives there and he knows the area to make sure that nobody's watching. And him and Summer had obviously been up all night. Nobody's going to go to sleep after what had gone on. So Bobby says, to hell with this. And he walks Summer and the baby outside, starts the truck, and then runs around to the other side and gets in. They head into town. And he actually drops Summer off at a local hospital first, and then he heads into the police station. When he arrives at the police station, Stephanie's parents are actually in the lobby at the time, filling out a missing persons report. She had never not returned home. And she didn't have a cell phone at the time, but she had a pager. So she always knew that if her parents paged her, you know, you got to make that call right away. So Bobby sits down, tells the police the entire story, and within a couple of hours, by 10 a.m., they have everybody on scene, and they're recovering Stephanie's body. And so the search begins for these three men. Not 2 hours later, at noon, they catch the three guys trying to rob a convenience store. All three are arrested. Without incident. Didn't fire a shot at the cops. Nothing. Willingly go in. Instantaneously, as soon as they start talking, Mathis and Alfonso both turn on Clayton. They want to cut deals. This was all Clayton. Clayton handled every bit of this. The prosecutor sits down and says, you know what? I don't really need you guys. We don't have all the results back yet, but we have DNA all over the house, all over the crime scene. We have footprints. We've got a million different things. We got fingerprints all over both trucks. We've got everything that we need. I don't need a deal from you guys. So they go back and forth.
Amen.
They go back and forth for a couple hours, and it's really Mathis that's pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. You know, to where he's basically willing to testify against anybody at this point to get himself out of it. So the DA comes back and he goes, all right, life sentences for both of you. If you take them, this is the one time you get this offer, and that's it. Well, went back and forth. Before it was all said and done, they ended up getting 20 to life. So parole after 20 years was a possibility. Not a fan of that for what that situation was. This is not one of those situations where you're with somebody, they do something stupid, you're genuinely in fear for your life, and then you go to the police afterwards to where you weren't really part of the crime. These are super active participants in multiple rapes,
yeah.
felonious assaults, and murders.
I mean, right off the bat, you're involved in a three-hour rape.
Yes.
I mean, you deserve the deepest, darkest place.
Right. I mean, if there was ever the type of crime that I think warrants a death penalty without murder, that alone would have been enough for me just for how heinous that crime was.
I mean, exactly.
Right.
Couldn't say it better.
So in 2000, he's sentenced to death, and he remains on death row for 14 years. So this brings us to January of 2014. Clayton writes a letter to the governor of Oklahoma asking for clemency. So this is a little bit different than the way that most of these clemency letters go, though.
Well, what in God's name could his basis be on clemency?
Well, he takes full responsibility for everything. Says that he had an idea that this might be part of what would have to happen, depending on what kind of people were in the house, because they didn't know when they broke into Bobby's house. There could have been six people already in there. To where he said that he knew in that moment when they broke in that if he had to start firing shots, he had no problem with that. So he took full responsibility for the entire thing.
Still don't see the reason for clemency.
Well, he also gets into some mitigating circumstances of his life. It's a sad story. I don't think it's enough that holds up, though. They've fact-checked all of this. They believe that all of this is true. His father began giving him weed at the age of 3 and physically making him smoke it so that he would go to sleep. By the age of 9, he was lazy and didn't want to do some work, so his dad made him take a bump of coke to get him jacked up, to get him to do a bunch of work. He said that he would steal things for his dad in order to not get beat, to where if his dad wanted a tool or something like that, he would do that. By the time he was 16 years old, he had a rap sheet with about 15 offenses on it, and he got busted for a felonious assault. Well, with the other things that he had in his past, At the age of 16, they put him in a maximum security Oklahoma State penitentiary. At the age of 16. To me,
wow.
To me, that is the one big failure in here by the system. I don't care what they've done. If you're going to put them into that kind of environment, it needs to be in solitary confinement. You cannot expose a 16-year-old to Gen Pop in a maximum security prison. What happens?
Yeah.
He's there for exactly 6 days when he is gang raped by three other men in the prison at the age of 16. So they do put him in solitary until he's 20. At this point, he's on death row anyway, so it's basically solitary. You know, I mean, it's crazy what this kid went through. Well, the governor reads this whole thing. She comes out and says, while she feels for Clayton, that there's absolutely no doubt in her mind that a life sentence just would not be justice in this case. Stephanie's family decides to go a step further. They actually send a letter to the governor, and they request the reinstitution of the electric chair.
Yes.
They were told, though, sorry, we're not going to be cranking up the volts here. We're going to be going with the lethal injection. Sorry. Well, Stephanie's family got that information in January of 2014, and they start a three-month crusade. They go to everybody they can get onto, TV networks, everybody that they could apply to the state. They wrote senators, everybody that they could try to see if there was anything that anybody could do. And at the end of it, there was just nothing that they could do. They said that the crime definitely fits a death penalty, but we're not going to reinstitute something that wasn't in practice before this happens.
Ooh.
Right? So, interesting enough, Clayton actually files something at the same time. Once his clemency is denied, he files for an injunction by the state because they are going to be choosing him to be the first person to use an unknown drug cocktail. 2014, states aren't putting out there ahead of time what they're using. It just wasn't the practice. They're not going to give that kind of information away. Well, everybody knew that the main distributor back then for the drugs that were being used in executions was a company named HASPO Incorporated. It's a foreign company, and they had stopped selling to all the states that were using them for capital punishment. So the drugs are becoming scarce. So Oklahoma said, that's all right. We've already got a plan for this. So this brings us up to the morning of April the 29th of 2014. This is the day of the execution. At 5 a.m., the guards approach Clayton's cell to get him up to start the preparation for the execution. He refuses to get out of bed. And one of the officers can actually see that there's some blood on the corner of his blanket. So they say, okay. They get the riot guards, the elite unit that inside the prison, whenever something goes on, they bring them in. The leader of the group orders Clayton out of bed once again. He doesn't comply. They tase him on the spot, wrap him up in the blanket that he's in, and they take him down to what would be the execution holding cell that he was headed to anyway.
Can't be the first person that's ever denied wanting to go to the execution chamber.
No, I don't think so at all. So they go in, and the officers actually recover a blade from a shaving razor that he had made a really crude attempt to cut his arm to where he had tried to off himself by slitting his wrist. There wasn't enough there. It was broken to two pieces. So they take him down to the infirmary. They get him patched up, and by 11 o'clock, they've got him back in his cell. Well, at this point in time, he's distraught. He wasn't able to off himself, and he says, I don't want my last meal, and furthermore, I'm just not going to drink or eat anything for the rest of the time I'm here. He did take one short, about five-minute phone call with a couple unidentified family members, and that was absolutely it. Spent the afternoon completely by himself, no television, nothing, isolated. So at 5:50, he gets brought into the death chamber, and he gets strapped in. There was one nurse that was there, and she's there to run what's called a pick line, where they're actually going to put the stuff in. You know, they're going to push the three-drug cocktail.
Yes, sir.
So she starts off down in his wrist, where they thought that they had a pretty good place to put it, and it doesn't take. So she moves up further. There's one in his bicep that looks like it's going to be a pretty good place. That doesn't work. They go to the crook of his elbow. No dice. So over the next 20 minutes, they actually have the coroner, who's in the room with them, and a doctor that's on hand, try to work this, the three of them. They go through 28 different locations.
Yes.
Sticking this guy.
Love it.
Trying to find a usable vein. finally, it's the doctor who makes the decision. He says, you know what? It's unconventional, but what we're going to have to do is we're going to have to go through the femoral artery. For those of you that don't know, the femoral artery runs right through where your torso meets your leg, right down in the crook of where your hip comes in, right? On the interior of your leg. They said that this is one of the absolute three main ones in your body. You have to have this. It's big and it's thick. This is going to work. No problem. So they go ahead and they get him tapped in. And the curtains finally open at 6:20. So the warden gets up in front. There's about 12 people that are watching the goings on. And reads the death warrant. Asks for any final words. He said, let the execution begin. Real smug and shitty.
He said that?
He did. So at 6:23 p.m.
What a doucher.
Yep. The first drug gets pushed. This is midazolam, right? So this is the sedative that they give to put you to sleep, right? So Clayton's laying on the table, and he's alert, and he's alert, and he's alert. Finally, at like 6:33, in what happened in a matter of a few seconds, all of a sudden he gets a little flicker of the eyelids, and his eyes go closed, and he's out. So finally, we got there. They don't know if it was the drugs that he had some kind of a resistance to what was going on, but hey.
Or if he's just fighting it.
Well, they've got him out now, so it's time. So they decide that they're going to push the second and third drugs simultaneously. These drugs were vercomonium bromide and, of course, potassium chloride. Well, they get started, and it's a slow push because they're pushing them both together, and they don't want to take a chance of blowing the line. So instead of the standard how you watch it, you know, it's a real slow push. Midway through the push, all of a sudden, Lockett opens up his eyes and tries to get off of the table. And then he yells, oh man, I'm not. And then he goes into this massive convulsion. And he is convulsing and gurgling like he's possessed on this table. It was described later in the paper as looking like the monster of a horror movie trying to escape. Like something that's not even human anymore trying to escape a situation. Another minute goes by after all of this, and he yells, something's wrong! And it's a real elongated. They said it was one of the most visceral things they have ever heard.
I'm sorry, but it's funny.
It's now 6:36, a full 13 minutes since the start of the execution. This is important because up to this point, anything that involves potassium chloride, nationwide average for total death time is 10 minutes. We're at 13 minutes, and this guy is awake. At this point, the warden calls the doctor over. They start talking to see what's going on. Says, you need to do a full inspection of what's going on. This is what they discover. The needle that was placed into the femoral artery was the wrong size. In order to go through the femoral artery, because it's so big, they recommend a 2.5-inch long needle. What did they have hooked up? They had the 1.25-inch needle that's made to go in your wrist, crook of your elbow, or your bicep. They didn't change it out.
Should have went with the electric chair.
Right. So what actually happened with this is they were trying to push too much solution through this at one time, and it wasn't able to handle it. And what it did is it actually causes the vein to blow out. So instead of the cocktail going straight through the veins like it's supposed to, it's now blowing through the vein and being absorbed into his body tissue. Right? I mean, how crazy is that? The doctor pulls the IV out, and again, sounds like a scene out of a movie. Blood goes everywhere. One shot of blood, when he pulls this out, actually hits the ceiling 8 feet away from the base of the gurney. This is the 12-foot-high ceiling, right?
Now, I can just see the authorities going, oh, fuck, what the fuck's
going
on?
I mean, right?
But you know what? I'm laughing. The reason I'm laughing is because these fuckers, some of these fuckers deserve this shit.
Oh, I'm not going to deny that, but the shit show's not over. Clayton, after about 45 seconds, is literally covered in his own blood. Literally, his face, all the way from the waist down. There is blood all over this guy, and it's all his, right? Three of the walls, the only wall that doesn't have any on him, is the wall behind him. So the wall in front and the walls on both sides were between 6 and 8 feet away, all have blood on them. So you have the ceiling, the floor, him, everything. The doctor actually has this on the entire upper half of his body because he was the one that was down there working when all this exploded. Had it, like, literally this guy's blood on his face, which that would freak me out.
Sure.
To not know what's actually in this guy's bloodstream.
Gross.
Right? So at this point, Clayton's on the gurney, and they stop the execution. Obviously, they're not pushing any more drugs right now. So you have him laying there in absolute agony at this point, and you have the warden, three executioners. So there's actually three men that form a triumvirate to kind of do this. The doctor and the coroner that are all together discussing, what do we do in this situation?
Something's wrong.
Right. So basically this falls on the doctor, and the doctor says, hey, I can find another vein. Okay. If I find another vein, though, do we have enough drugs left in the system that we can push this and give him a lethal dose? The coroner and the executioners, who actually are well-versed in this, say there's no way. We have less than half left of what we're supposed to have. It's never going to happen. So it's actually, and I'm sure they seem like to an eternity, they don't close the curtains on this. So all of this is going on with family witnesses and stuff right in front of them.
Yeah, and I bet you the families of the victims are like, are you fucking kidding me?
I mean, right? So after 5 minutes, they decide to call the execution. Like, no more. They're going to actually end exactly what's going on. As they begin to take him off of the gurney, he goes into a complete seizure. They said that it actually broke a few of his fingers, that he seized so bad that it was snapping the bones in his fingers.
Well, because he's still got some of these chemicals in his body.
Yes, and then all of a sudden, everything unclenches, and that's it. He had a massive heart attack as they were trying to pull him off the gurney. At the end of this execution, we'll call it quote-unquote successful, takes 43 minutes.
Yeah, baby.
From start to conclusion.
I guarantee you an electric chair and a hanging wouldn't take so long.
Correct. So, upon review, because obviously when something like this happens, there's going to be a panel review of exactly what happened. Interestingly enough, what they find is that the drug combination that is used at this time is actually being used in three other states very successfully with none of these results. What they found out was the amount of drugs that they were giving was 20% of what they were using in the other states. It was 500 milligrams, 1,000 milligrams, and 1,000 milligrams. In other states, they issued 100 milligrams, 200 milligrams, and 200 milligrams, and that would have been if they would have got it all in, which they didn't even get it all in. So this thing was beyond off, right? The other thing that they didn't have that is actually a staple of any lethal injection now is that you have to have a minimum of 2 IV PICC lines ran prior to them pushing. So if something happens to where you have a vein collapse, this is where him not drinking anything actually plays into it, because he was dehydrated to where they think that that actually contributed to the vein collapse.
100%.
Right? Absolute pandemonium crazy. They try to sue the state, the family does, for cruel and unusual punishment. They said the court ends up ruling, and they fought this all the way to the state Supreme Court. The federal Supreme Court decided not to hear the case. They said, we hear what you're saying. Yeah, it took longer than expected, but at the end of the day, the execution that was meant to be carried out was carried out. It was determined that the potassium chloride is what caused the heart attack. At the end of the day, that's what's supposed to cause the heart to stop. Not perfect, but it was effective. The family got no money.
Good. Amen.
So last couple notes here that I thought were interesting is this is our first, what I would call, a botched execution. If he had gotten off that table and they had got him back to his cell, who knows what would have happened? He might have gotten a commutation at that point, because I think you're only allowed to try to execute somebody once. So my question then becomes, what is the fail rate of executions?
Great question.
So if you go by category, the fail rate on firing squad since 1933, 0%.
I would imagine that's correct.
That's cash money every single time.
You've got 7 marksmen and they don't miss.
Surprisingly, the electric chair, 1.9%.
You're telling me that there's some people that got lit up and lived?
That it failed, and there's another case that we'll do another time to where they did it, it failed, they brought a tech in, finished it, and then executed him the next day. Now, this was many years ago. I don't think it would happen in modern society, but that's how it happened. Surprising one to me, the gas chamber. 2.4% failure. I mean, not to sound too crude, but aren't you basically hooking up car exhaust and pumping in carbon dioxide until somebody is no longer with us?
I don't really know how that works, so I don't know.
We'll have to do a little bit more research on that, but I was surprised that the gas chamber fails. I would feel like either because there's something broken with it, or for some reason somebody just has an immunity to the gas that's coming in.
I don't know how long they push the gas.
Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of crazy.
It's got to be like 15 minutes because if they don't, I mean, there's people that can hold their breath for a long damn time.
It's true. And then finally, lethal injection. 7.4% of the time, it's considered botched.
Jesus.
That is a staggering number to me. I mean, from what we've talked about with some of the phenobarbital that they're using now to where it's just a single drug, they push it, it works 70% of the time, it works every time. You know what I mean?
I'm sure also that the gallows are probably 100%.
Gallows are 100% because you hang till you're dead.
Right, you hang till you're dead anyway.
But it had that in there to where they basically said that unless the rope breaks, you know, or like a structure fails, there's no way around that. If you have to hang there for an hour, you hung there for an hour, it's not botched. Did you do it clean and did you do it the most humane way?
No.
But in the interview, after it was all said and done with the family, the dad was borderline giddy. He came out and he said, we couldn't have asked for anything more. He said, if you're not squeamish
about... The dad of Stephanie?
Yes. He said, if you're not squeamish about blood and you feel like there needs to be justice against somebody that killed one of your children, it's hard-pressed to find a way that would make me happier than to see almost an hour of suffering.
Hear, hear.
So that is the story of the execution of Clayton Lockett. Couple questions to finish up.
Yes, sir.
Now, I thought that this was interesting because there's a lot of message boards. This wasn't that old. I mean, this execution was in 2014. There were a lot of people that feel like Summer and Bobby should have gotten into some kind of trouble for this entire thing. Had Bobby not been dealing... This is what people are saying. This is not what I'm saying. I'm asking a question. If Bobby hadn't been dealing drugs, this situation never would have happened to Stephanie. If Summer hadn't made her go into the house, this never would have happened to Stephanie. Everything from that point on, obviously, they didn't have control of. They were no longer in control of the situation. Do you think anything should have happened to Summer and Bobby?
Well, I mean, they were dealing drugs, but I mean, what are you going to give them? I mean,
Bobby for the drugs was the one thing that I could say maybe.
Bobby got his ass beat by these guys. And obviously, Summer paid a huge price for this.
Yes.
And I'm sure it was because they knew Summer was Bobby's girlfriend.
Yes.
So she took the brunt of all this.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure she paid the ultimate price for what was going on. Not the ultimate, but she paid a pretty heavy price.
That's a pretty heavy price.
But should the authorities still come back on Bobby and give him time for selling drugs? I mean, they could have, but I mean, what are you going to get him? 6 months and 6 months probation?
That's what I thought. And obviously he didn't go through what either one of the girls went through, but he went through a lot. And we didn't elaborate it too far on it, but I can't imagine what it would be like in that moment to be a parent of a very, very, very young child and to be concerned about that child's welfare.
I'm sure he thought they were all going to die.
Right. Like, I do not mean this in a negative way towards any of the other victims that are involved in this, but if I'm in that moment, the baby's number one. God help everything else that happens in that situation. Your main focus is getting that baby out of there.
Absolutely. And like I said, as soon as this first and second shot were shot at Stephanie,
yeah,
I'm sure he thought we're all dead.
Yes. I would have felt that. I couldn't believe as I read and researched through it that they let him go afterwards. I mean, they just witnessed an execution. Second part is when it comes to what Alfonso and Mathis got, they both got 20 to life. Should they have gotten less, or did they get the right amount, or should they have been getting death sentences for this too?
I mean, I'm probably really wrong on this, but they weren't the shooter. They were active rapists. I think an active rapist should get at minimum 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
Minimum.
I'm fine with that.
40 years.
Sure.
So life, because they were accomplices, maybe. I don't like the 20 years and then they're on parole.
Yeah.
I'd say for them, I would give them a stiff 60 years.
Yeah.
And be happy with that.
Yeah. I was delighted to see, just as a little side note in here, that they were both rejected last year. At their first opportunity at 20 years, they were both rejected, which means they're both doing at least 30. So 10 years from now, they're gonna be up for it again.
So it's every decade they're up?
Yes.
Wow, that's still a long time.
I know. You walk out of there with another 10 years. I hope that stings.
Yeah, I hope that on 30 they at least get rejected at least one more time.
I
want to see them at least do 40 years for this.
I have to say, to me, I would not have been upset if Mathis would have gotten the death penalty as well. I'm not.
He put the dirt on her.
I'm not on Alfonso's side. Alfonso's a piece of shit. I'm not going to deny that. But his role in the initial rape and everything that was going on, okay. But once they get out to the final crime scene, he's not actively participating in any of it at that point. He's literally just standing
there.
Yeah,
but he's not running home either.
Well, that's true. The one thing that I looked for and I was trying to find information on, and I couldn't find it, was whether or not he was armed and holding Bobby and Summer.
Sure.
If he was, then I think that ratchets it up a little bit, because if you're holding a gun while two other people are actively raping somebody, you have some power in that situation to stop what's going on.
Sure. If you don't like it, you could say, this is enough.
If he turns on those two and shoots those two to stop the situation that's going on, I feel like he comes out of this better.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, not a good person, but at least at that point he would have saved a life.
Oh, no. He was thinking about getting his rocks off and having his way with his girl, just like the other ones.
Absolutely ridiculous. So I already know a little bit about what your answer is going to be to this question, but how do you feel about the botched execution? And I don't mean just the joy of it, because we can touch on that too, but do you feel like if, as a state, you are going to present that this is the way that we're going to do this, and you don't follow through with it, should there be anybody in this circumstance that is held accountable for the shortcomings? I mean, the wrong needle, didn't have two PICC lines in, didn't have enough of the actual medication that we're supposed to be using.
This was in 2014, right?
Right. This wasn't the first time this was done in 1976, the first time back out.
Or even 1913.
I mean, do you feel like anybody involved with the execution?
No.
Should have been, or do you feel like there needs to be something in place that draws these out a little more? That's not 13 minutes to sleepy time.
I think there should be more people with less knowledge doing these executions so we can have more stories like this.
Yeah.
I'm sorry if I offended anybody when I laughed, but I'm not sorry, actually, because these people are terrible murderers in most cases.
Yeah.
In almost every situation. Sometimes they've killed more than one person, and I think that if you're going to do that, then you deserve what you get.
Yes.
If you get a quick execution, you're lucky.
I agree.
If you get a bad one like this dude, well, sorry. It must have been karma.
Yeah.
At some point, karma will survive and persevere.
It will. Last question before we get to the final question is, do you think that the question that was asked of the state by her parents, by Stephanie's parents, to choose the method of execution, do you think that there should be three or four choices that somebody gets to make that choice? Because clearly what they wanted for justice, and this wasn't like 3 days later, this is a long thought out process. 14 years later, they're still clearly not happy with the entire situation, which obviously you're not going to be. Do you think that they should actually get input on this?
I mean, yes, of course. We've had this conversation 100 times, and of course, yes.
I do too.
I think
this is the first time I've seen a petition for it, though.
If not a choice, why don't we do this? Door number one, door number two, number three. Let's see what you pick.
Right. Get Monty Hall in there, make a deal.
Yeah, absolutely. Behind door number one, there's the firing squad. Behind door number two is the electric chair. Behind door number three, you get the sleepy potion.
Yeah. I think that that's something that it sounds medieval, and I think there'd be a lot of people that don't want to participate in that decision. But I think if you want to participate in that decision as the next of kin, the first family member, like somebody's got to have the ability to say, you know what, this is how this should be done.
I agree 100%. I at least think not every state would give you the option, but the states that might give you the option, absolutely. You know what? Mrs. Reynolds, you get the first choice.
Yep.
They killed your son.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like to make that choice?
Yes.
No, I would not. Okay, well, then the state will make it for you.
Yep.
This is what we're going
to
do.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I know that that's a progressive way to think when it comes to executions, because most people think that people that have the opinion that executions are warranted aren't progressive thinkers. I think there's a progressive way to do things that more fits what we're trying to accomplish in society.
Absolutely.
So, and as always, the final question: was justice served in this case?
Absolutely. I mean, we got the two accomplices that could have got a little bit more stiffer than the 20 years probation, but they still got life. They might be there for a long time.
I agree. That could have changed a little bit, but the fact that it was only a 14-year stay, which is way below what most people get on death row.
Is that what his was?
14 years.
That's nice.
14 years. The execution went on as planned, even though he tried to stop it, and he didn't go out super pretty, so I'm pretty content with the way that this finished up.
Well, you can tell by my laughing during the
the
execution that I was satisfied.
Yes. So my thoughts and prayers do go out to the family of Stephanie. We do hope that you guys have had some level of closure and healing for this. We continue to pray for you. Everybody look out for yourself and one another. If you know anybody that's dealing with any kind of a mental health crisis, substance abuse, anything like that, please call 1-800-622-4357. Somebody will help you on the other end, whether it's for you or somebody you love. Don't be afraid to make that call. You can stop something like this from happening.
Absolutely. So if you are having bad thoughts about hurting yourself or someone else, or you just can't kick that drug, call the number.
Thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to talking together again real soon.
Stay safe.